Last week, I talked about Confucius, the first person to whom the title of a secular, ethical, and political thinker could be applied. Today, I want to talk about a distinct figure on the other side of the Eurasian supercontinent, a little bit after Confucius, a chap named Aristocles, whom we don't know by that name. We call him Plato. Now, Plato was rather different from Confucius in some respects, rather similar to him in others. Confucius was a member of the minor aristocratic class who had to find himself a new task to do because members of his class were at loose ends as a result of the collapse of the single main Chinese kingdom, the Zhou Kingdom, and its replacement by what was then called the Spring and Autumn period. Plato was, like Confucius, a member of the lesser aristocracy. And he had an education appropriate to his class. What he did with it was a little bit different from what Confucius did, inasmuch as he acquired a philosophical education from one of the most important teachers in late 5th century Greece, a chap called Socrates. Socrates is a rather interesting figure because we have a number of different depictions of him from a number of different people. And because these depictions vary according to who is writing them, we get very different Socrates. Plato's Socrates is a wise, thoughtful philosopher. And to a very large degree, he's a vehicle for Plato's own thoughts. But some of what Plato's Socrates said is what the historical Socrates also said, because Plato was a student of Socrates, and to a very large degree, what he is transmitting to us involves what Socrates transmitted to him. Socrates forms the boundary between two categories of thinker. Early Greek thinkers, natural thinkers, political thinkers, social thinkers, whom we all call the pre-Socratics, and who lived in the period either just before or just after the Persian Wars, and all post-Socratics, every Greek thinker after Socrates, who represent a qualitative as well difference from those before, where pre-Socratic thinkers come to us in fragments, in small excerpts found in other people's work. What we have from Socrates on are more complete works. We even have a very large set of Socratian fragments and Socratian statements in the writings of others. We have no Socratian writings themselves. Socrates did not believe in writing, and he did not trust writing as a means of transmission of ideas. Nonetheless, we have Socrates presented to us in writing by a number of different people, of whom the most important for our purposes is Plato. Now, Plato was a brilliant man. When I was studying political theory back in another century, in another era, in another world even, my teacher, Tracy Strong, kept insisting, Plato is smarter than you or I. And it is worth keeping that in mind. Plato was indeed smarter than I am, and possibly smarter than you, the listener, are. But Plato did not know everything, nor did his teacher Socrates. And it is this fact that I want to stick to. Plato, like Socrates, like Confucius, is responding to a time of crisis. He is trying to come up with a way of answering the larger question that a world in difficulties and in a dark time presents to us. And that question is, what on earth do we do? We are really in crisis. We don't know what to do. Plato says, I have an answer. That is not an easy answer. It is not a simple answer, but it is nonetheless an answer. And the answer is a simple one. We do not live as we live now in the best form of state. We live rather in a form of state that is designed for and by the worst kind of people. We need to live in a state made by and made for the best kind of people. A state made to create the best people. A state made on the principles that will ensure that its citizens will be the best kind of citizen. That means that we have to live in what is the ideally best state in order to have the ideally best people. Now, you will note that Confucius, in essence, is saying that if we have the best educated people, the people who are taught the best principles, you will thereby acquire the best state. Now, Plato is arguing that if you have the best form of state, you will thereby acquire the best citizens. This is sort of the inverse of Confucius. Confucius says, best form of training produces best state. People come first, state comes second. Plato says the state is prior to the people. That is, if you have the best form of state, you will get the best kind of people as a result. Therefore, for Plato, what you have to do is identify what is the best state, what kind of people are going to be produced by it, and aim for the best state in order to have the best people. Now, the question then becomes, what kinds of state are there? What kind can we say is the best? What kind can we say, therefore, is the worst? What kinds are there in between? What, for example, would be the second best and third best and so on, all the way down to the worst kind of state? Plato has answers to all these questions. Plato has answers to them because he believes that the best kind of state would enforce a particular condition, and that as we move away from the quality of being best, we move away from that condition. And he names that condition justice. The best state is the just state. The worst state is the unjust or least just state, the state furthest away from justice. Therefore, we have to consider, what is justice? What would we consider to be a just state? What we would consider to be a just individual? Plato has to do all these things in order to tell us what the best state would be. We have to have the best kind of individuals being produced by it. So Plato has to give us a number of different kinds of theory in order to give us the best order, because justice has to narrow in from the wide conditions of politics to the narrow conditions of ethics. If we are going to have the best people, we must begin from the best state and narrow in until we have the best person, the best single moral agent. Because moral agency is not possible outside of human community. And human community is only possible if we are agreed on the roles that we can carry out as moral agents. There's a certain amount of circularity in this, but Plato wasn't really worried about that. What he worried about was the ability of the state to withstand crises, in particular crises that led to what he saw as the cycle of revolutions, a cycle in which states moved from being their best form to their worst form and back again. And he called this cycle, the stasis, the cycle of revolutions. And he wanted to figure out a way of moving off this cycle into a condition of long-term stability, which he considered the best state. So what's the best state? Under what kind of state can people be the best people? Unsurprisingly, it's a state run by people who are like Plato, philosophers. Now, the ideal form of the ideal form would involve being ruled by absolute rulers who are philosophers. But you can't quite get that. So what we have as the just state is a state organized hierarchically and via education into a state in which there are three classes. A broad lower class doing most of the work, a middle section which did the policing and securing, and a small upper crust doing the ruling, and this upper crust would be trained in philosophy. Now, why would it be trained in philosophy? Philosophers, and philosophers alone, Plato argues, rarely understand the world. They rarely see what is going on, unlike the vast majority of people who are trapped by illusions into thinking that the illusory aspect of the world, the things that we see with our eyes rather than understanding with our minds, are reality. Thus, for Plato, what we consider to be sensual reality, the reality that we can identify with our senses, is not actual true reality. To find actual true reality, we have to go beyond what our senses teach us and understand things that we can only understand by piercing the veil of the senses with the use of our minds. We cannot understand reality simply by looking at it or listening to it or touching it or tasting it or smelling it. We have to use our minds to tell us what our senses are attempting to communicate to us. This is the famous allegory of the cave. What if we are all in a cave and chained down facing the back of the cave? On the back of the cave, we see shadows flickering against the wall. And these shadows are produced by lights outside the front of the cave, outside the cave entrance, in front of which people and animals are passing. And fires beyond them cast shadows, which we see on the cave walls. And believing those shadows to be real, we accept them as reality. But some of us break free of the chains, emerge from the cave, and see the reality outside the walls, and then return to the cave and tell us, the ones trapped in the cave, that there is a reality which is casting these shadows. Do we believe them? Or do we reject what they say because it does not fit with our preconceptions? That becomes the question. Very often, Plato says, we will reject what we are told in favor of the evidence of our lying eyes, because we do not see all the true reality. We cannot appreciate all of true reality. We are limited in our perspective, and therefore we need the guidance of those from whom the shackles have been removed. We are less than capable of understanding true reality, and must be guided by those from whom the shackles have been removed, from whom the blinkers have been removed, who can appreciate what is actual reality. But obviously, the philosophers, those who have managed to pierce the veil, are going to be few, and they are not going to be very powerful. So they must rely on the strength of others. And Plato's ideal state is built on the philosophers relying on what he calls the auxiliaries, a class of people trained to military service who will police the majority on behalf of the minority of philosophers. Now, Plato's minority of philosophers is not a self-perpetuating class. Neither is his class of guardians, his class of police and soldiers. These are people selected out of the general population by examination. So what we have in Plato's ideal state is meritocracy. You will be chosen by your merit to be a philosopher, or to be a guardian, or to be one of the common herd who does the work, whether it be construction, or farming, or trade, or whatever. So you have a three-class system. Plato suggests reinforcing this by a mythology, arguing that in the ideal state, people are made by the gods of three metals, gold, silver, and bronze, and that the task of each person is determined by the quantity of each metal in them. How much gold there is in you, how much silver, how much bronze. Thus, if you are a person of gold or almost all gold, you must be a philosopher. If you're a person of silver or almost all silver, you must be a guardian. If you are a person of bronze or almost all bronze, you must be a worker. And these are immutable qualities which can be found out during the process of education. As a result of the process of education, you will be assigned your proper place by the philosophers who lead your community. And you will be assigned thus the proper reward for your service. Now, this serves to create a system of hierarchy blessed by the gods and designed to ensure long-term stability. Is it perfect? No, it's not. Plato believed that reality as it exists was caused, first of all, by a derogation, a stepping down from the ideal state into what he called the second best state. The second best state was something called timocracy or timarchy, military dictatorship. And this second best state was exemplified by the realm of Sparta. Sparta was a military aristocracy ruled by a small aristocratic class called Spartiates, sustained by a much larger class of peasants called Helots, who were the serfs of the Spartiates, and a class of dwellers about called the Perioeci, who were free peasants who had very, very limited rights and abilities, and who were essentially persecuted by the Spartiates as a means of controlling them. So, a state of equal soldiers ruled over subordinate peasants and oppressed slaves or serfs. This is the second best state. The worst kind of state, according to Plato, was a democracy. Now, it happens that Plato and his students lived in a democracy called Athens. But Plato believed that democracy was morally bad for you, because democracy allowed you, the free citizen, to do as you liked, so that you could do one thing in the morning and then change your mind and do something else in the afternoon, without committing to either that one thing or the other thing. You could be a painter in the morning, a merchant in the afternoon, or a philosopher at 6 o'clock in the evening, without committing to one of those things. You could be, in short, a dilettante. And Plato thought this was morally bad for you, just as it was morally bad for you, being all of these different things, to participate in governing the state, because you would not have the expertise necessary to govern. And that expertise necessary to govern, that would be the category of philosopher. You would have to be a philosopher to understand things in their depth in order to be able to govern. Because government is not a task like cleaning shoes or working leather or making pots. It is an art of an architectonic sort. It is one that needs the art of construction, of building beyond the ordinary. And for that you need philosophers, not simply people with skills, but people with particular skills and abilities and empathy, who are educated beyond the common. So that you have, in Plato's mind, to have a government of experts, a government of well-trained experts, who will know from the beginning what to do, because they will have the philosophical education necessary to carry it out. I want to add to this just one basic theme. Plato, as an aristocrat, did not trust ordinary people. He particularly did not trust ordinary people who lacked the kind of education he had and lacked the kind of wealth he had to govern him. As an Athenian citizen, he did not like the idea that an ordinary free Athenian who worked in the fields or worked at a trade could have as many votes won as he did. He might have had other objections. For example, he might have objected to Athenians who mistreated women, say, as having the same vote as he did, he treating women with more respect, or viewing the Spartan treatment of women, perhaps, as more worthy. Because Plato treats women in the Republic rather differently than other Greeks treat women. And that's an important fact to be considered. Other Greek thinkers, for example, Plato's student Aristotle, do not see women as equal to men. They see women as having a subordinate role in the state and in the family. Plato does not. Plato does not see men as equal to women, and vice versa. However, he sees men and women as occupying a range of abilities, each of them. And the range of abilities of women and the range of abilities of men overlap. And that includes the abilities of the best women and the best men. So that the best women are capable of becoming philosophers. They won't necessarily be the best philosophers, but they will be capable of becoming philosophers. Therefore, there should be women in Plato's ruling class of philosophers. This is a remarkable, for the times, position to take. And this has endeared Plato to a good number of feminists who are willing to overlook Plato's tendency to dislike democracy and to be hostile to the lower social orders because of his surprising feminism. And it is certainly true that in comparison with other thinkers of his time, Plato was a feminist. But does that amount to so much? Plato is in essence saying upper class women should have more room for action than lower class men and women. But he's still taking away power from the lower classes. And it is not much of an addition to the world to say upper class women should have rights I'm going to deny to lower class men and women. And I should like to have some police women as well as some policemen. And I should like to have, as is done in Sparta, but not in Athens, women train with men for in the gymnasia, where, by the way, training was done naked, both in Athens, where only men trained in the gymnasium, and at Sparta, where men and women trained together. Now, this might raise some eyebrows, or it might cause teenage boys to giggle, but it was the case, and nudity was given a different value then than we give it now. And it was a different culture. We have to understand that in Plato's Athens, women were seen by men as playing a different social role. They were seen primarily as bearers of children, or if they were seen as social companions, this was as an adjunct not to their role in the family, but as an adjunct to their role as entertainers and sexual but not personal companions. I'm not sure to what extent we can say that this matters for us today, because we are not going to try to enact a Platonic Republic, at least not on the terms Plato would want. But we want a better state than the one we have. And as a result, we look to thinkers like Plato to provide us with pointers as to the best kind of state. Plato had an experience in his own time that led him possibly to question the validity of his own approach. And that is, he went to advise a ruler, Dionysius, the tyrant or lord of the city of Syracuse in Sicily, as to how best to govern. Dionysius does not seem to have liked Plato's advice, imprisoned him, and threw him into slavery. Plato's friends were able to buy him out of slavery, but the experience, it is alleged, taught Plato a salutary lesson. And it is possible that a document that we have supposed to be from him, the so-called seventh letter, may be the fruit of wisdom he learned from the experience of slavery. And this letter is a criticism of positions he had previously taken, and an adoption of what we would today call a republican, with a small r, form of government. That is to say, a government formed by consensual agreement of the governed, rather than by imposition from above. If so, then we have to consider that Plato may have developed other forms of politics later in life, that in fact the positions taken by Plato in his other political works may represent a maturer, more thoughtful Plato, and that we may want therefore to look at Plato's later works as a better guide to his politics than the Republic. If so, then we are going to have to reconsider what we consider Platonic government to be, and we are going to have to place Plato's ideals as closer to those of Aristotle's. And it is Aristotle that we will come to in a little while. And that ends this particular essay in Political Thought.